This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. While markets are digesting a second straight 75 basis point hike from the Federal Reserve and a promise to carry on in its fight against inflation, and Tim, we also got a second consecutive quarter of negative GDP growth in the U.S. It was a lot.
It was a lot. All of this, though, Carol, set against a backdrop of an earnings season that's really kicking into high gear right now. I mean, here are a few names, right? Microsoft, Alphabet, Meta Platforms, Apple, and Amazon all reporting this week. In fact, that's, you know, a market cap, half of the market cap of the S&P 500. Pretty incredible.
Like, blows your mind.
It really does. So ahead on this broadcast, we're going to talk to a suite of top executives, including the CEOs of Chipotle and Mattel, on their latest results and their outlooks for the rest of 2022.
We're talking burritos and Barbie. We're also going to speak with the founder and CEO of Suzy Cakes, go behind the scenes of an HBO drama, and dig into regulators' delayed crackdown on popular buy now, pay later platforms.
It sounds like a pretty good program.
I would stick around.
All of that to come. We begin, though, with a catch-up on crypto from the finance section of the magazine. Digital tokens plunged this year. They've taken the crypto exchange Coinbase down with them, too. Now, U.S. regulators are investigating the company and whether it improperly let Americans trade digital assets that should have been registered as securities.
Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin is here to break down the battle between Coinbase and the SEC. It's a story that takes us back to September of 2020.
We've had two things that have happened over the last couple of years with Coinbase. As the kind of crypto markets have boomed, this company has moved kind of closer into the kind of center of the cultural zeitgeist. And as the company approached a direct listing last year, one of which is that the company kind of embraced this kind of like culture war thing. It basically told its employees that they couldn't, protest in favor of Black Lives Matter, which won a lot of praise from, right wing types, who are sort of into that kind of thing. And at the same time, the company was sort of making some pretty significant changes to its business to allow more of these kind of lightly traded, they're sometimes called altcoins, if you want a clean
word for it.
These,
for that.
These are basically, it's like the crypto equivalent of a penny stock. So some of them, of course, are legitimate. Some of them have sort of gone nowhere. But what has happened over the last year or so is that Coinbase went from being, kind of seen as a relatively sober-minded, one of the more conservative of the crypto exchanges insofar as that's possible, to kind of embracing a more edgy, confrontational pose with regulators. Part of that is this kind of like cultural component. Part of it is listing lots and lots more of these altcoins, probably most famously Doge, which is like a joke cryptocurrency that the company added in May of 2021.
So I do wonder, what's the responsibility of these companies to investors, in terms of what they are offering up? Like, buyer beware, like who's responsible at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. And Coinbase has done some of that. The thing that happened to this company is that, you know, as I said, it followed initially. Coinbase has a long history. You know, it's been around, I think, for almost 10 years, backed by some of the biggest names in tech. What happened is that it sort of fell behind the ball on these kind of lesser known currencies. So you had this sort of meme stock moment happen, and competitors, most notably Binance, basically distinguished themselves by allowing a lot more different securities, we're not allowed to call them securities because that's kind of Coinbase's whole position, but these different digital assets. And Coinbase, kind of in this frenzy to catch up, I think, basically allowed a lot more of these things on, and that's kind of where they find themselves today, where you have this Department of Justice arrest of a former Coinbase employee who's, you know, accused of basically insider trading, and then you have the SEC saying that some of these tokens that were being traded are in fact unlicensed securities. The upshot of that is that, you know, the SEC is you know, maybe suggesting or interested in the question of whether or not Coinbase is operating a, you know, unlicensed security exchange, which would be really bad for the business. They put out, after these complaints dropped, the DOJ one and the SEC one, and it's important to say that Coinbase has not itself been named in any of these complaints. You know, they're not charged. They haven't been sued. And although, you know, Bloomberg has reported on this, you know, investigation, you know, the SEC hasn't taken any formal action. Their position, the company's position, is that it doesn't list securities. These things are digital assets. And therefore, you know, it's in full compliance.
I guess I almost wonder too, Max, like, if we find out that there's some internal conversations, you know, basically to the extent of, yeah, we don't really think this is anything, but we got to put it on our platform because if we don't, somebody else is. Like, you do wonder, like, what's the responsibility of a company and its leaders when they maybe they don't believe in something, but at the same time, they know investors are interested in it.
Right. And this has kind of been something I think has been kind of whispered about in crypto circles, but maybe not said publicly until these, you know, until this happened last week, which is that, you know, there are a lot of assets on Coinbase that are pretty obscure, right? They're not, it's not like Bitcoin and Ethereum. It's things like Pawtucall, which is a, you know, social network for pets, right? It's very lightly traded, and you know, you can buy it sell on Coinbase. And
amazing.
You know, there's a question about what, when you invest in that token, what exactly are you doing? And I think the kind of Coinbase position, right, is that you're buying you're not buying a security, you're buying some kind of token that's going to be useful in this company. But I think the reality is a lot of people who are transacting in these digital assets are basically gambling, right? And then so there's a question about whether or not that should be regulated. And then there's also a question of whether or not, you know, there's even a problem with that.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin.
Coming up, Mattel CEO talks toys, Barbie dolls, Hot Wheels, and Elon Musk.
Yeah, you gonna buy an Elon Musk doll if they have one?
I don't know. That sounds kind of weird. That's like kind of a weird question to ask. If he comes with...
Okay, sorry. How about an Elon Musk action figure? Is that better?
As long as it comes with a Tesla and a SpaceX rocket.
Okay, fair. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the Fed's hoping its latest 75 basis point hike will help bring down prices, and so is our next guest. Enon Kreiz is chairman and CEO of Mattel, the manufacturer, of course, of Barbie and Hot Wheels, and so much more.
America's second largest toy maker recently reported second quarter results. Even as persistent inflation weighs on margins, Mattel, well, it's maintaining its full year guidance.
These were excellent results for Mattel with our eighth consecutive quarter of top-line growth. Our profits also grew significantly with adjusted operating income up 82% despite high inflation. And following a record first half, we expect to continue growing in the second half. All in all, we're very happy with the position we are in. We expect to win market share going forward, and we reiterated full-year guidance for strong top-line growth, increased profitability, a higher gross margin, and all of this is in spite of significant inflation and negative currency impact.
So are you like, come on, investors, you so got it wrong.
Look, we are very focused on managing the company. We have been growing now consistently. We're executing on our strategy. We won market share for 2 years in a row, and we expect to win market share this year as well. Our supply chain is in very good shape. All of our owned and operated factories are fully operational. Product is flowing in. We're expecting a second half retail sales to be above the first half levels. We're seeing the industry growing as well.
What happened that your margin shrunk that maybe even caught you guys by surprise?
No, the margin impact was expected. It was factored into our guidance. We talked about it at the beginning of the year. And if anything, it's getting better, actually, because we did revise our guidance on gross margin, not by much, but nevertheless, a positive uplift. We're able to offset negative currency impact and maintain and reiterate our guidance for the full year. So the margin reduction was very much expected and, as I said, factored into our guidance in the beginning of the year. Over time, we do expect that the combination of pricing and cost savings will more than exceed the impact of inflation and contribute to margin expansion.
Give me an idea of what you're seeing with pricing power right now. Where are you able to raise prices so that consumers will continue to pay, but you can better cover increasing costs on your side without destructing demand?
Yes, pricing is one of the options we consider in times of inflation. This is not obviously unique to Mattel or unique to the toy industry. But we've said before, and we're being very consistent about it, is that when we raise prices, we always keep consumers in mind. We're being very thoughtful and strategic and are committed to maintaining the highest quality and best value for consumers. We haven't seen any negative impact from the pricing actions we took last year. We just took another action that will be factored into our numbers in the second half. And this is something that we previously announced, so this is not new news. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen a negative impact. These actions are very methodical and thoughtful.
What is selling? What is not? Where are you seeing maybe some consumer sensitivity because of the overall inflationary environment?
Well, in the second quarter, we saw comprehensive growth, 24% in constant currency. Mm-hmm. We were up in double digits, strong double digits in North America, EMEA, and Latin America. We grew in all of our reported categories. In our three power brands, Barbie, Hot Wheels, and Fisher Price. Hmm. So the performance was pretty comprehensive with some really strong numbers. We did say that Hot Wheels, as an example, is on track to achieve its fifth record year in a row. Barbie is just coming off an all-time high in 2021, and we said that we expect to be sales for Barbie to be comparable, so we're holding a very high bar.
Right,
and all in all, be a pretty strong performance across the board.
So we were talking about the Barbie movie. Do you anticipate making more money from the movie and your partnership on the Barbie movie, or more from the lift that the Barbie brand gets thanks to the movie?
No, we absolutely see this opportunity as incremental to our toy business. Our strategy to capture the full value of our IP is about participating in highly accretive business verticals that are adjacent to the toy industry and are also driven by big franchises and big brands, but we want them and expect them to be accretive in and of themselves. Mm. So the partnership the Barbie movie and the partnership that we have with Warner Brothers is such that we have a meaningful economic participation in the Barbie movie, as well as, for that matter, all of our movie projects. We do have economic participation. And of course, we understand that in success, there will be a benefit for the toy business, but we do expect economic participation outside of the toy aisle as well. We do not fund the movie. We do not participate in movie financing. This is not our expertise and not our business, but we do participate economically both as the IP owner, as the owner of the brand, and as a producer. We are producer on all of our projects.
Do you get a piece of the box office, Enon?
We haven't been specific on the commercial terms, but box office and receipts are part of the equation of typical
right.
participants.
Hey, can we talk to you about SpaceX? Tell us about the collaboration. It's a multi-year agreement that Mattel has announced with SpaceX to produce toys and collectibles.
Yeah, this is an exciting partnership to create space exploration toys and collectibles under the Matchbox brand. The toys will come out next year. The collectible toys will be available on Mattel Creation, our direct-to-consumer site. And this is really about, scaling our portfolio. It's about innovation. It's about thinking out of the box and bringing new partners to the toy aisle.
That was Mattel CEO Enon Kreiz. Still waiting on an update, though, on that Elon Musk action figure, doll, whatever you want to call it, Carol. He was pretty mum on that.
Well, certainly more to come on Bloomberg Business Week. Our C-suite lineup continues with the CEO of Ecobat. Find out why he says lead is the world's best recycling story.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. But he's also thinking about how the pivot to EVs with their lithium-ion batteries is also affecting his world. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Bloomberg NEF recently reporting how the tipping point for battery electric vehicle ascendancy has been reached globally. And it's about once 5% of new car sales go fully electric, everything changes, according to a Bloomberg analysis of the 19 countries that have made the EV pivot, which kind of got us wondering about battery recycling overall.
Well, fortunately, we got Marcus Randolph with us. He's executive chairman, CEO, and president of Ecobat. It's the world's biggest recycler of batteries. Marcus, give us a macro view of your world right now and help us understand the biggest challenges your company's facing.
Let me start with the quiz. I love this because it sort of helps people understand what batteries are about. What do you think is the most highly recycled product?
So I know what it is because I looked at the website.
Yeah,
I'm
but
sorry.
You put your paper out on the curb, yeah. Lead battery recycling, 99%, and 99% recovery of lead through the recycling process. So lead is by far the world's best recycling story.
And we're talking about batteries like Duracell batteries?
No, those aren't lead.
So lithium ion, just lithium
ion?
Well,
I'm referring to lead acid batteries now.
So you where would you find those?
Well, car batteries.
Car batteries,
you know,
right?
Those big black boxes
both
you got
batteries.
In your cars with the two little posts on them? Yeah, those things. So we recycle 130 million of those a year.
So what happens as we move to EVs? What does that mean for you?
EVs does two things. One is it opens up the world for lithium ion batteries, which
correct.
Are very different. But one of the things that gets missed is EVs also use lead acid batteries. So a lot of people say lead acid batteries are going to die. They're going to be replaced by lithium. Not true. You know, they're still going to be used. Admittedly, they don't use as much lead acid as a car does, but it's still a substantial part of our going forward business.
So how much demand or what are you seeing like in your business?
The thing you're never going to get away from is what does it mean to have this big boom in EVs and what is that going to do for lithium? So, you know, the low end of projections is sort of 20% compound annual growth rate. You know, that didn't really matter much when, you know, you're just selling a few of these a year, which is where we were 8 or 10 years
Everybody's
ago.
Worried about lithium
you
and
know,
whether
but,
or not
but
we have enough.
But now, I mean, you know, including plug-in electric hybrids, last year there were 6.6 million electric vehicles sold. 6.6 million, almost double what they were the prior year. So you say, where's this industry going? For us, lithium is both our greatest threat and our greatest opportunity. So you look at what we're trying to do as we go forward, and that's to be, we are by far the industry leader in lead acid side, and we are rapidly becoming so on the lithium side.
Because you have to.
Because we want to. You know, to be honest, I mean, it is going to be challenging for lead acid batteries over the long term, because lithium are just, their energy density is much more favorable and their ability to fully discharge is better. So they have big advantages, but on cost, they get killed. And so if you have low cost applications where you need big surges of power, that's right down the world of lead acid batteries. As you get over to cars that have long, steady draws that last for hours, lithium batteries are fantastic.
Right.
They're just expensive. They're hard to recycle. So I give you the numbers for lead acid. 99% recycling and 99% recovery. Lithium recoveries now, the EU is trying to legislate 65% recovery, and there are a lot of companies that aren't making it.
How usable is it on the other side of that recycling?
It is and it isn't. You look at lithium batteries, you know, the lithium, nickel, and cobalt deposits in the U.S. are not very good. So all this stuff comes from someplace else. Then the manufacturers are very interested in retaining control through the recycling process. So lead acid battery, you get rid of it out of your car, you leave it at Pep Boys and they give it to us and it just disappears in the system. In lithium, the car manufacturers want to own that stuff right through the process. Kind of the takeaways here is you're going to see a lot of demand. I think there are a lot of questions about, is there enough supply? You know, the recycling is really important, particularly because the manufacturers want to own the resources.
But it's
a different world.
But the question I think that you're asking is, when you recycle it, is it 99%? Comes back to, right, the manufacturer, or is it 50%?
Like, where does it go?
You did well, actually. So what happens? So they don't have the deposits, so they ship the materials here, they make the batteries, or they make them in China. By the way, China has, you remember the gigafactories? Well, China has about 10 times more than the U.S. does. So you start severely disadvantaged. You don't have many gigafactories. You don't have many resources. Then you get on the back end of this, and right now there isn't a single company in the U.S. that can make cathode quality lithium ion batteries. So they process it here, send it back to China, then it comes back here again. You know, so where this industry's got to evolve is it needs to get to where we have the full cycle processing capability here. And we're somewhat unique as EcoBat, because we're in the front end of that. And we do the logistics, the discharging, the disassembly, the shredding, the production of what's called black mass, which is sort of all of the metals in one. Then it goes off to others who handle the very back end of the process.
Right. Based on what you're seeing, this pivot, right, to alternative energy EV, what are you seeing, or how quickly?
You know, as you think about the story in lead, it is the best recycled product. And it's also, if you don't get it right on the recycle side, you are not going to have the climate changing elements necessary to deal with wind power and solar power. You need energy storage.
That was Marcus Randolph, CEO of EcoBat. The company calls itself the world's biggest recycler of batteries.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, we go from batteries to burritos. Another big quarter for the king of fast casual dining. We're talking Chipotle Mexican Grill.
Get me some guac right now.
That's going to be extra.
All right. We catch up with the CEO, Brian Nickel. He joins us next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of Chipotle Mexican Grill rallying big time this week on Wednesday, the day after releasing its latest quarterly update. The fast casual giant reported second quarter earnings that topped analyst projections.
The burrito maker is adding new locations and customers are proving they're willing to pay more. The company also provided an upbeat sales forecast despite rising food costs and pressure on those wages. Those are going up.
Mm-hmm.
Chipotle Chairman and CEO Brian Nickel joined us to help break down the numbers.
Our customer mix definitely over indexes with higher income. And we saw that group actually increase their purchase frequency with us. And their spend was also a little bit up. So what we concluded is we've seen some trade down and people are switching some occasions into Chipotle. So we feel like we're gaining market share for our company. And then at the same token, we did see a slight slowdown with the lower income consumer from a purchase frequency standpoint, but not in their absolute spend. And, you know, the thing that was really powerful for us throughout the quarter is our restaurants were staffed and our team members did a great job of servicing both our digital business, which is roughly 40%, and our frontline business, which is really accelerating as people kind of come back to normal routines. And you know, that was really the thing that I think carried us through the quarter. And then obviously our brand has tremendous value. And as a result, we were able to pass through some pricing to offset a lot of the inflationary pressures we've been dealing with.
Brian, I got to ask you, I mean, restaurant margin, 25.2% in the quarter compared with an estimate of 25%. Yep. Were you just kind of blown away by the outperformance, considering the declines we've seen in consumer sentiment and so much recessionary talk?
I really think it goes back to the strength of both our teams that are executing in our restaurants, because, you know, they're the ones that turn the top line into the bottom line based on how they perform in the restaurant. And then I think the strength of brand, which is, you know, it's really based on great culinary, great ingredients, you know, customization and convenience. And I think we did a great job of executing against all those markers. And as a result, you know, we were rewarded with people's business that then our teams did a great job of executing so that it flowed to the bottom line. You know, to achieve a 10% comp and also be able to deliver the margins at the restaurant in this environment, I think it speaks a testament to just the value proposition, the strength of the brand, and the strength of the people working in our restaurants.
Let's talk about wages, because labor costs for the quarter were increased about 30 basis points from last year, 24.8%. You did that wage raise last year, that sort of widespread wage increase. Are you going to have to do that again?
You know, we are continuing to see pockets of needs to do movement on our wages. The good news for us is we took a really big move about a year ago, which you may. And then really what we've been doing is just monitoring kind of at the local level, what's happening with wages and opportunity at our company so that we can attract and retain the right people. And we still are dealing with, pockets of challenges on that front.
Where are those geographical pockets?
Yeah, and it's almost, look, it's like store by store. It's not contained to one region over another region. It really depends on what I would call kind of the market area. You know, there's a lot of dynamics that go into it. Is there big box retail nearby? What are the other alternatives for the employee pool that we compete with?
While you raised wages pretty much across the board last year, Brian, not necessarily you will have to do the same thing this year, or you might have to.
No, we're still moving forward with merit increases, and we did a little bit bigger merit increase than usual given the inflationary environment, because we don't want to fall behind on wages either. I should probably caveat, we're trying to run our wage program on more of a system basis, where it happens every 6 months. We reevaluate wages, you know, we pass along merit increases, and also we provide promotions for folks. And before, we were having to come in between those because the competition to get labor to work had really increased dramatically because there were fewer people applying. Luckily, that seems to have gone to more of a normal pace, where applicant flow, as well as our ability to then retain people, is starting to get more, I would say, to a normal approach for us, or normal run rate.
I got to ask you, only because it's been another story that we've been following for the last few months about unionization that we're seeing certainly among, you know, restaurants. How do you guys feel about that? Or is that part of your move to make sure you stay ahead of when it comes to higher wages? Because would you prefer that your restaurants don't become unionized? Or are you okay about it?
Yeah, look, I really don't see the need for a union at Chipotle. I believe our jobs and the culture and the opportunities are best done within our restaurants and within our company. We don't need a third party to be a part of that conversation. We've got great wages, okay? They're great jobs. We're a growth company. You have the ability to join our company with, you know, a high school degree or some equivalent. And also, if you talk to any like new immigrants or refugees, this company delivers jobs that deliver the American dream. And I can share many stories where, you know, I was just with somebody that was a refugee from the Congo. He's now one of our highest level general managers, making six figures, leading a multi-million-dollar restaurant, a team of 30 plus people. And the guy is electric. And you know what? He's going to be able to continue to grow with us.
Yeah.
There's a young woman. She immigrated from Chihuahua, Mexico, single female, didn't know English, learns English. You know, 9 years later, she's our top restaurant general manager in the entire company.
That's impressive.
So, there's just tremendous opportunity for people to go from a crew position, work their way up to being a general manager, becoming what we call a restaurateur, which is our top general managers, becoming a multi-unit leader. Right. And when you're building 300 plus restaurants a year, there is so much suction for people to get promoted and moved up. I think last year we promoted, you know, like 19,000 people. Just tremendous opportunity. And I'm very proud of our company, and I'm very proud of the jobs that we provide to our people.
Hey, Brian, a lot, though, still out of your control, especially when it comes to costs. And this is something that we heard Fed Chair Jay Powell talking about, the rising costs across the board, especially for food. You did, though, say that other parts of the business, you've seen prices plateau. Where has inflation been transitory in your business?
Don't mistake that for transitory, because it hasn't gone backwards, right? The good news is we finally had, like, I don't know if you can call this a trend, but we had like a month or two where we didn't see everything going up. But as you mentioned, we had some major inputs going up still, and in a meaningful way. And that's why, you know, unfortunately, we got to take another price increase in August. As much as I hate to do it, we're fortunate that our brand has the pricing power to do it, and we can maintain the integrity of our value proposition.
Was it, what ingredients are you referring to? Was it chicken? Was it steak? What was it that plateaued?
It was more in the proteins, so like pork, beef, and some produce items. Unfortunately, packaging, aluminum, dairy, tortillas, avocados, chicken continue to have a lot of pressure.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, Brian, I mean, you're continuing to grow in terms of the number of restaurants and especially the pickup windows. So where is it that you really continue to see growth in terms of the types of restaurants you want to be opening up?
Yeah, well, look, the restaurant, the Chipotle format is, you know, a traditional Chipotle with a pickup window where you don't have to get out of your car. Mm-hmm. And those restaurants, we now have 430 of them. Wow. And I think the last time we spoke, or maybe the first time we spoke about this, I think when we were talking about it, we had like 10. And this was back in like 2019. So it just shows the power of our development. But they continue to really perform. You know, our digital business is about 15% bigger in that execution. And then the total business is also opens at a higher volume as well. So that's 80% of what we're building. We just opened our first one up in Canada to a really successful opening. And then just recently we opened one in kind of a smaller town outside of California. It was like a new record opening for us. So it's got a lot of momentum. We'll continue to build the inline Chipotles as well, where we can't get the Chipotle, but it's clear consumers like the additional access point of not having to get out of their car. And it really is the fastest drive-through experience you can have, because you've ordered ahead, you've already paid for it. If you order a fountain drink, that's the thing that you got to wait on. Otherwise, you pull up, say your name, and you know you got a burrito and you're ready to go.
Hey, Brian, about a year ago, we were interviewing you and I asked you about Chipotle accepting crypto. And I got to be honest, you kind of laughed it off. And here we are a year later. And, you know, June of this year, you announced that you now accept crypto at U.S. locations, this partnership with Flexa. So essentially people load up this app with their crypto, and then you accept that app at the restaurants. How's that going right now? What percentage of sales is in crypto at this point?
It's a really neat tool that Flexa provides so that people can monetize their crypto. But, you know, they carry all the risk, and it's a very, very small percentage of sales. Arguably, it's almost negligible. But, mm-hmm. You know, for those that have it and want to monetize it, we found, a pretty clever solution.
All right. But you are doing the buy the dip game, right? And if you win,
you could get a bunch of crypto. We got a lot of creative people in our marketing department, I'll tell you that much.
Well, but why do a promotion and tie it? Even Dogecoin is in there. Like, so no. But it is interesting. Is it just kind of it appeals to your audience? And, you know, what is it?
Yeah. You know, look, we have a commitment to stay relevant, both in culture, food culture, you know, music, you know, I guess tech falls all the way to this idea of crypto. And I think the team does a fabulous job of staying on the front end of where young people want to be. And then also being very relevant. You know, I never want our brand to be out of sync with the conversation. And, look, the reality is the things that drive culture, right? It's food, it's fashion, it's sports, it's music.
Right.
I think it's tech. So we want to be present in those things.
That was the chairman and CEO of Chipotle Mexican Grill. We're talking about Brian Nichol. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenebeck. Ahead in our next hour, the cover story, the massive credit trap forming underneath the millions of people using buy now, pay later platforms.
Don't you feel like you could see this one coming?
Yeah. I mean, from a mile away, how is this any different than a credit card?
Exactly. It just seems like that trouble was coming. We're also going to go back behind the scenes of the second season of the HBO drama Industry. It's set to premiere on Monday.
Yeah, that's a fun one. And the entrepreneur behind the cookies and cakes and more of Susie Cakes.
I just like saying Susie Cakes.
Well, we got to go to California or Texas to get them.
All right.
Or you can order them.
That's true. You can order. All right. That's all coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a season two preview of the HBO series Industry. The show's co-creators take you inside the high-pressure and cutthroat world of high finance.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. I binged the whole first season of that.
You did?
I did. Oh, yeah. It was great. Plus, female founders secured just 2% of venture capital last year. That's according to a Bloomberg story from back in January. The CEO of Suzy Cakes is overcoming that trend by baking her way to the top and helping other women do the same.
She's been doing it for a while and has really gone through a lot of tough times in kind of the overall economy. So looking forward to her story. First up this hour, this week's cover story. It's about buy now, pay later companies known as BNPLs. They include big names Affirm, Klarna, and Afterpay. Each offers installment financing with an attractive hook. Pay quickly in four rounds and there's no interest. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, sounds amazing, right? Yep. What could go wrong?
Right.
Credit though, Carol, is credit. Mm-hmm. And regulatory bodies in the US and Europe are starting to sniff around now that more users are getting in over their heads. Joining us with more are Bloomberg investigative reporter Esme Deprez and Businessweek editor Joel Weber.
What really stood out here was how much we were all suddenly being inundated with sort of these offers. Like you go to a checkout and it's sort of like, you know, do you want to pay in four easy payments? And we were sort of like, where did this come from?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It is suddenly everywhere. And lo and behold, it really took off during the pandemic and we were all doom scrolling. And it turned out that this industry just boomed on it. But now we're seeing economic headwinds, regulators have taken note. And lo and behold, there's good old-fashioned debt problems, even when you're,
right.
You know, supposedly paying in four easy payments. So Esme, as you kind of dove into this topic, I'm curious. There's a real fundamental loophole that the buy now, pay later industry is built on, which was, it's one thing if you pay in five payments, but it's another in four. Why that distinction and why does it matter so much?
Yeah, so this story really focuses on the pay in four model in particular, and that's what really unites these companies. So Affirm, Afterpay, Klarna, they all kind of do different stuff, but their main product is pay in four, or one of their main products is pay in four, and that's what they all do the same. And so the way that they were able to really change the consumer credit game was by bypassing consumer protection regulations. That explains one of the reasons why these have just seemingly exploded overnight. And so if you take the Truth in Lending Act, for example, that's a landmark law enacted in 1968, and it requires extensive disclosures for what are called unsecured consumer loans split into payments of five or more, the law doesn't touch pay in four because it's pay in four payments.
How big has this industry become?
Usage has increased, you know, over the past few years, usage has increased 300% every year. So consumers, you know, they're really making up a larger part of particularly e-commerce spending. They're slowly creeping into brick and mortar, but it's really just e-commerce. So we're looking at like, you know, a few percentage points of consumer spending online, but obviously growing, you know, every single day. As far as valuations, I mean, if you look at Klarna, the value has dropped significantly recently, but it's still worth $7 billion. Afterpay was sold to Block, the digital payments company, for $29 billion.
Incredible.
So these companies are very big. They're making hay. They're minting billionaires.
You know, that Klarna headline, you know, when the valuation got slashed recently, was really interesting because it was sort of like if everything seemed like it was going great for this industry, and then you saw that valuation get slashed, and it was sort of like, wait, what? What is your reporting bear out there? What's going on with the industry, and why are valuations maybe tenuous suddenly?
There's a number of reasons. So first of all, losses are up. They're seeing, you know, more people. obviously, you know, usage has increased, so they're having more customers, but also more customers are, you know, unable to pay back their loans. So investors obviously don't like that. Stocks are way down. You know, competition is increasing. Apple recently announced that it would get into the game with its version of Pay in 4 called Apple Pay Later. PayPal joined the crew a couple years ago with its version of Pay in 4. You know, even big banks these days are looking at BNPL. But also we saw, you know, we looked at Consumer Financial Protection Bureau complaints, their database, and complaints are mounting. And then, of course, regulation is likely coming. The FTC is now looking into this industry and trying to really figure out, like, what kind of consumer harm is happening. And we definitely found that there was absolutely consumer harm being happening. I mean, in part because it's just so easy to get these loans. You know, the credits, the old traditional credit system, you know, excludes people unfairly a lot of the times, but it also sometimes, you know, prohibits people from being able to take on debt because they truly cannot take on debt. And this is a problem. You know, the BNPL industry often will give you a loan even if you can't qualify elsewhere.
How do they make money if they're not charging you for the, you know, ability to pay back over time?
Exactly. You know, usually Pay in 4 is always interest-free. You can get hit with late fees. But primarily what BNPL companies do to make money is that they charge the merchant a percentage of whatever it is you're buying. And the merchant thinks that that's worth it because you're more likely to buy with these things. And then also your cart is going to be bigger. You're going to buy more stuff because you think that it's cheaper because you're only paying in four, you're paying in four payments. You also, you know, they do some, Klarna and Affirm, for example, also have longer term interest loans that they offer. And so they make some interest off that. But this is kind of their main selling point. I mean, they really say the merchants are their primary customer. You know, we as shoppers think that we're getting the good deal, but really it's merchants that are their primary customer. So that's really the best. And that's also what they say helps distinguish them from credit cards makes them better than credit cards. Because credit card companies, you know, credit card issuers, they make a lot of money off of the interest and fees that they charge on people that don't pay their bills on time.
That was Bloomberg News investigative reporter Esme Deprez, along with Business Week editor Joel Weber.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, the co-creators of investment banking drama Industry.
We had this big issue thinking, God, does anybody actually want to watch a TV show that features COVID?
Spoiler alert, you're going to want to tune in. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, if you didn't have plans for your Monday night, now you do. On August 1st, the second season of the investment banking drama Industry returns to HBO.
I can't believe we're already at August. Can you?
Are you going to? No. Are you getting ready for another binging round?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I highly recommend season one. And after catching up with the show's co-creators, Mickey Down and Conrad Kay, I'm even more excited for season two, Carol. Mm-hmm. It has been a couple of years since the show premiered back in 2020. I mean, they filmed it before pandemic, right? Yeah. We asked how they addressed that time gap.
We had a pretty natural hiatus from a storytelling point of view because obviously there was a 2-year gap between the end of the first season and when it's airing season two. And it gave us quite a big creative decision because obviously the biggest thing that's ever happened to workplaces in the last, 100 years happened. And we had this big issue thinking, God, does anybody actually want to watch a TV show that features COVID? But what we decided to do was sort of jump the characters forward, start them in a psychologically quite different place to where we saw them at the end of season one, and make sure that COVID was sort of texturally in the story and quite kind of do it with a light touch, but also, make sure that had a psychological impact on all the characters, but make sure it didn't drive the plot too much because we didn't think anybody wanted to be plunged back into that kind of, working from home world.
How do you think about the evolution of the series and the topics that you want to cover?
It's really funny because we had some really good consultants in the first on the first season, and obviously me and Conrad used to work in finance, but, we're 10 years out of the game now, so it was really helpful to have some people who were on the ground. And in season two, we had some really, really good consultants. We had a sort of secret consultant who's a pretty high-profile guy in the industry. Who would not want me to name him. but he was really, really good at giving us some sort of ear-to-the-ground stuff. And it was really odd because all the things that we came up with in this season seemed to have come true. I mean, there were sort of these little things. I mean, there was obviously... Yeah, there were some very esoteric things we touched on this season, the idea of CRMS, and there's the idea of telehealth, and obviously the response to the COVID pandemic and all that stuff. It feels like it was quite nice to be able to try and predict stuff and see what actually happened. And obviously it's a pretty tumultuous time in financial markets at the moment, which is always great for good drama.
Hey, Mickey, I'm wondering how, from a writing perspective, you bring people up to speed on what, not that they missed in season one, but since so much time has passed between the two seasons, how you remind people of what actually happened. Are we going to see some sort of previously on, or how do you handle that as a writer?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and especially since, because of the COVID pandemic, there has basically been 2 years in between the seasons. I think the first episode of the second season is a little bit of a balancing act, because you obviously want to throw people into the deep end and not have too much throat clearing and too much reminders of what happened in season one. But obviously, especially given the time gap between the two seasons, you don't want people to be lost either. I think practically there probably will be a sort of season recap, but there are a few little sort of nods to the first season and reminders. But I think it's even if you haven't seen the first season, I think this season sort of stands up, and we throw the characters back in, and then the inciting incident of Harper coming back into work after a year of isolation is a pretty relatable one, and I feel like that's the sort of
right.
That's
all right. I got to ask you, there's a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the series. And Conrad, come on in. Let's start with you, Conrad. I mean, keep it clean. It's a family audience. But I mean, is that the reality of what you guys saw when it came to the financial world?
The answer we always give to that question is it's obviously slightly sensationalized. When people always say, oh, is this based on your sort of biography or your lived reality of working in these places? We obviously, it's not a documentary. We're making a TV show, so we obviously sensationalize things and lean into certain things. And me and Mickey, because we're a creative partnership, I think we're very, we're kind of a bit braver in some of how bold we are, because we wrote that stuff with each other. We try and push each other, and we always, for some reason, maybe it's because we're demented, we always land in quite perverse places. But just to talk about the sex scenes, I know you have a family audience, but like, we're very proud of, people are always like, oh, is it gratuitous, is it objectifying, and like, we actually think in season two there's actually more sex, but weirdly it's more character based. We feel like we're telling more story, and it was the dialogue we were having between the actors, the intimacy coordinators, the producers, it was a very much a kind of a concerted effort to make those things really feel like they were earning their place in the show. And the one thing I will say, for the people put off by the sex and the drugs in season one, and obviously you have a more financially skewed audience, me and Mickey are incredibly proud of the finance story that anchored season two in a way that we never really dug up into the real weeds of that stuff in season one. I mean, we feel in season two we've actually rendered it even more authentically.
Well, Mickey, come on in and finish up with us if you could, because I do love that you guys get into hedge funds and the private wealth management division. We talk about it here. I mean, people in our world are getting richer and richer, and they just need more and more advisors in private wealth divisions to manage it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's the picture of private wealth management is, I'd say, pretty sensationalized. I mean, I actually did an internship in private wealth management. That was my first ever job out of university, and this is a little bit of a piece of revenge against them, I think, for not giving me a job at the end of it.
I like it. Some real honesty there.
There are personal aspects that make their way into it.
So, guys, no banking after this? You're completely done with banking? Does it make you want to get back into it, give it another shot?
Banking is done with us. I think banking made its mind up when they fired Conrad and they pushed me very, very keenly towards the door.
Conrad?
But it is funny actually writing about it, and me and Mickey have this awful term for it where we're not in finance anymore, because we're writing about it, we're kind of finance adjacent. And you realize just how many incredibly unique and strange and idiosyncratic characters are in that world.
Our thanks to Mickey Down and Conrad K, co-creators of the HBO show Industry, talking all about season two. And I looked it up, Carol, the first three episodes are called Daddy, The Giant Squid,
and the Fool.
Oh my God. That alone just makes you want to tune in.
What's going
to
happen?
The giant squid. All right, we've got to check it out. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, the sweet taste of success.
As life gets more complicated and people are, you know, on their devices more and more, this premise of connecting through celebration with face-to-face and sharing a cake has really resonated.
The founder and CEO of Suzy Cakes joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
So cakes, cupcakes, cookies, bars, pies, and pudding, Suzy Cakes is celebrating its Sweet 16.
Yeah, and if you're from California, or perhaps you've been to Texas or California recently, you might have seen a Suzy Cakes in the flesh. Well, Susan Sarich is the founder and CEO of Suzy Cake. Take us into the origin story here, because you've got a pretty great beginning taking the recipes from your grandmother's and building a really what's become an empire.
Thank you for that. Yes, I grew up in Chicago, and both of my grandmothers, Mildred and Madeline, lived across the alley from each other. So while I was growing up, we always had some great desserts around the house. Fast forward, I went to hospitality school for college and then worked in the hospitality industry about 15 years. While I was in food and beverage and hotels and restaurants, I noticed a lot of women leaving the business because it was difficult to have a family or have a life outside of work working 24/7. So I drew up a business model predicated on women having careers in hospitality without having to sacrifice other areas of their life, combined with these amazing 3x5 handwritten recipe cards I had from my grandmother's.
So let's talk about your business, though. I think about 16 years in, you have made it through the financial crisis, the pandemic, and then today's supply chain stresses and more, and also an environment that continues to be disrupted in innovation, whether it's in the food space, how we work, who's working. How do you think about it today and how you run it?
You know, one thing I've always been is very true to what our core mission is, which is connecting through celebration and not trying to be all things to all people and just being very good at what you do. And so what I have focused on since day one was creating the highest quality scratch-made products combined with the highest level of guest service to all of our guests, and being very straightforward and open about what we're doing. Our kitchens are open. We use high quality ingredients. We don't sacrifice on that. And I think as troubling and up and down as the economy has been, and times are, people really want to celebrate now more than ever, to be able to bring that joy to people and bring your mindset to a simpler time. A lot of people tell me our cakes remind them of their childhood, or, you know, when life was easier. And so I think that Suzy Cakes has really thrived over the past 16 years, because as life gets more complicated and people are, you know, on their devices more and more, this premise of connecting through celebration with human beings face to face and sharing a cake and celebrating somebody has really resonated.
How's it going for you at your locations throughout California and Texas? Are you having a hard time keeping employees? Are you having to raise wages? And are you seeing differences in different areas of the country?
It's been very challenging, actually, in both areas of the country. And, you know, in order to meet the decreased labor market early in 2020, we had to quickly alter our business model to fewer days, fewer operating hours per day, and fewer product offerings. So we really had to lean heavily on technology and have a focus on driving more sales online. So as a result, we've increased our online sales from 6% to 31%, which is huge, but that allowed us to have less team members in the store taking orders and having an easier production model, creating less waste. We actually ended up with a more profitable business model.
You pitched your business for like 2 years. Is that fair?
Yes, I'd say the better part of 18 to 20 months. Yep.
Wow.
Was it just that?
Yes.
Because we talk about this a lot at Bloomberg. About the ability or inability of women and certainly minorities to attract investment dollars. What was it? Was it just because did you bootstrap or did you get money or like tell me about it?
No, very bootstrapped. Literally everyone who I spoke to and showed my business model to said Susie Cakes was a bad idea. And even the FDA said, Susie, baking is a hobby, not a business. It was incredibly frustrating and difficult at times to keep going, knowing that so many people were saying, and people I respected, were saying that it was a bad idea. And so our really only options that we had were bootstrapping and, you know, gathering money from friends and family who would, you know, at least, you know, have a little bit of faith in me. To get the first store open. So much of my time outside of work is spent on supporting the next generation of female entrepreneurs because they are still struggling with getting funding and, you know, it needs to shift. And I don't know what will create that shift, but I am still seeing it 16 years later.
That was Susan Sarich, founder and CEO of Susie Cakes. And by the way, they do ship nationwide. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they've got that famous Southern red velvet cake.
All right. Well, now I'm hungry. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, if you're looking for a European summer getaway, you may want to think outside the box.
Okay. So forget about France. Forget about Italy. Forget about Greece. Our Pursuits team tells us where to eat, drink, and stay in the distinctive country of Wales. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Time now for our weekly dive into the Pursuit section of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. We are thrilled to have not one, but two great guests to take us through it.
Yeah, we got Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rauscher with us. Also, contributing writer Brandon Presser.
Brandon traveled to the United Kingdom and to the longest place name in Europe to give readers a look at the amazing culture, food, and adventure that Wales has to offer. Maybe not the typical destination for European travelers. All right, so Chris, why was our intrepid reporter sent there and what did he find out? I want to know what this pitch was like.
Well, every year, as you guys know, we do a list of the places to go in the following year. It's one of our holiday traditions. We do about 25 amazing, interesting places to go. And for our 2022 list, Wales was on the list, and it was Brandon's idea to do it. And we included it in our places to go in 2022, and there's a real revival of Welsh culture on the international scene. So the Welsh food and products and drinks are really getting a lot of attention.
Okay, Brandon, so come on in here. Before we get to, you know, what you ate, what you drank, I just want to know what the landscape there is like.
I would say sort of very concisely, it's like Ireland on steroids. So you have all those touchstones like the jagged cliffs and, you know, the green pastures, but then you kind of kick it up 10 notches where these pastures lead to craggy mountains and the cliffs, you know, run 800 miles of coast. So it's very dramatic.
I don't think people do think about going there, but it sounds like there's just some wonderful things to explore.
I saw this. What? I'll be honest. I saw this and I was like, Wales? What? Why? Like, why?
I thought of Princess of Wales and Prince of Wales. Like, okay. That's where I went. I'm just going to tell you. Tell us what you found out.
Well, first of all, when I was telling people that I was doing a story on Wales, everyone was like, oh, yeah, you know, ocean conservation, you know, we really have to save the whales. And I'm like, no, Wales is the country. And they're like, Wales isn't the country. So there was a lot of, like, yeah, teaching amongst friends, first of all. So I sort of took that in mind when I was there. So for me, in addition to looking at the landscape, it was really about trying to identify and isolate the distinct Welsh culture as separate from the rest of the UK.
Can we get to the elephant in the story? And what is this long word name? None of us are going to be able to pronounce this. What is this longest place name in Europe?
So there's in the north part of Wales, there's a little island right off the coast called the Isle of Anglesey. And there's a small town, and all the town names, true to many destinations, are place descriptors. So because Welsh is one of the most ancient languages, there's a lot of compound place names. And this one is the most eccentric. It has 58 letters. It's basically describing a church of a saint near a place, near a whirlpool, near a forest.
You're not going to even try to say it? Can
Come
you try
on.
To say it?
I mean, I have a deep and profound respect for Welsh culture. And by attempting to say the place name, I feel like I would disrespect it.
Okay,
it does have a shortened name, though, right? Is it Llanfair?
Yeah, so the double L is like an aspirated, like, it's like Llanfair.
But a lot of the culture that you write about has to do with the language and the history of the language, because there are a lot of words in Welsh that don't necessarily translate to words that we would have in English. And a lot of them describe the natural world and, you know, what you eat and drink.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, hygge, that the Danish sort of exported as an idea of coziness, became this, you know, phenomenon. I have a friend with a hygge tattoo even. And basically, very cozy tattoo on her arm. And this is sort of the same thing. And I don't think that the Welsh are trying to actively export it, but they have so many words to describe the landscape. They live so close to the earth. They harvest from the earth. You know, the farm to table is meters, not miles. And so they have all these things, like pingo is the word that they use to describe a tree that feels very heavy with fruit.
So Chris, as you went through it, and as Brendan was reporting and maybe reporting back or not reporting back, like, what did you want to know? Or as you edited the story, what was it that just jumped out for you?
I mean, I wanted to know about the food. Honestly, you know, the best restaurant in the UK this year was in Wales, I think, for the first time. And there's also been this movement to do way that French has AOCs or Italy has DOCs, like denominations that protect food culture. Mm-hmm. Wales is starting to do that with its whiskey and with its cheese, just really marking how important that stuff is. So we want Brendan to taste everything.
Okay, well, let's do a little bit of that, at least, you know, however Brendan can explain it to us. And I want to start with the idea, Brendan, of the international element, because it does seem like the food there has, even though it's using local ingredients, the influence is really global.
Yeah, absolutely. I think since the terrain is so diverse and sort of surprisingly diverse, that you're having a lot of different culinary elements that are pulled from the mountains, from the pastures, from the ocean. So it comes together as like a very complex culinary canon that could actually rival France or Italy. They just haven't commoditized their culinary canon yet.
How much did you sample? I was thinking about the spirit.
Because
wasn't there one place
5 hours?
Exactly.
It's like a 5 hour meal? A 5 hour tour.
Yeah, or multiple.
Well, there was Inisir, which is the first Welsh restaurant ever to win Best Restaurant in the UK. I had been tracking down the chef owner and his wife and had been emailing them and texting them. And I was like, I really would love to come to visit. I know that you're really popular, but they had just won a second Michelin star. And so I had a feeling they were kind of on the rise. And it just so happened that the day that we had all agreed to meet was the day after they had just won this award. And they were like, you know, we can get you in, we can sneak you a seat. And it's really fun to do a 34 course tasting meal, but doing it alone for 5 hours was very focused on the food because I had no one to talk to.
I gotta say, this just sounds fantastic in terms of the food, what you can drink and what you can see, but what you cannot pronounce. We'll have to deal with that later. Anyway, everybody should go to the magazine or check out the story online to really see the name of this place that you cannot pronounce, or at least we can't pronounce in its entirety. Brendan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. It's another great read. And that, of course, is contributing Bloomberg Businessweek writer Brendan Presser. Chris, we want to explore a little bit more with you, though, what else is in the Pursuit section of the magazine. And I have to say, I love James Tarmey's story about Barbara Kruger, the artist who we probably all know her work, and yet it's interesting to see that it maybe hasn't risen in terms of value or popularity to some other kind of pop artists.
Yeah, so I love this story when James pitched it. Mm-hmm. James, you know, always wants to explain an artist's market to people. So like, to our readers who are very interested in investing in art. So he wants to tell our readers why an artist's work is valuable, why it changes in value. And Barbara Kruger is, she was a former magazine editor, actually, more magazine designer, who became an artist 30, 40 years ago. She was kind of around the same time as Warhol and some other people a little after that. And you recognize her work because, you know, you may remember the New York Magazine cover that she did, which was Elliot Spitzer when he had his downfall. And it was a picture of Elliot Spitzer. And it said in her famous red box with Futura white font, it just said brain, and it had an arrow pointing to his crotch.
It's iconic.
So she still does work for New York Magazine, but mostly she's a contemporary artist. Her work is near the top end of the contemporary market, and she's been working for many decades. But it never really started breaking the $1 million mark until pretty recently. She had a small but very dedicated group of collectors, and now there are these four shows all around the world. One's in Berlin, one was a Venice Biennale installation, and then MoMA in New York has one, and the Werner Gallery has a show. Her prices are boosting by 20% or more on the primary market, and that's a big move for someone who's been around for a long time, and just shows her strength and the way that she's talking about culture and capitalism.
Okay, and there's some really cool, the Supreme, the company Supreme, like if you see a Supreme shirt, you're going to recognize her work there. And there's some really cool backstory there. So I encourage everybody to check it out. But
Chris really wants to talk beer.
Yeah, I want to talk beer. I mean, I want to talk beer here. So we've talked like non-alcoholic drinks with you. We've talked about like non-alcoholic beer and non-alcoholic cocktails. But we're talking craft beer with alcohol, but without a key ingredient, gluten. Is it beer?
Exactly.
Yes, you can make beer without hops. Craft, we have a great craft beer writer, Tony Rehagen, and he pitched this idea to me, and I said, I don't know about this. And the story is a story about gluten-free beer, and it centers on these two, these guys, Trevor and Maureen Easton, who live in Wisconsin, love beer, and then one day Maureen became gluten intolerant. And her husband was like, I'm not gonna have you not be a part of this like tradition that we have of drinking beer. You're not gonna get left out of all this fun. So he started trying to home brew beer without gluten. And he says, you know, at first my only market was Maureen, his wife. And then they actually figured out a way to make it good. Now they have a huge market. They have a business that's national. And there's other people doing it, too. And the reason that they can do it now in a way that they sort of didn't before is because they're using different grains, which are more widely available because gluten-free dining is more common. So it used to be they used a grain that kind of gave like a sweet puckery flavor to beer, and now they use buckwheat, sorghum, rice, other things to get something that really tastes like the beer that you know and love.
Big thank you to Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser, and of course earlier Bloomberg contributor Brandon Presser.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe, everyone. This is Bloomberg.